This is Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, your daily voice in Washington, D.C. on the issues of faith, family, and freedom. And now, here's your host, Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Good afternoon. This is Eben Fowler with Bot Radio Network sitting in again for Tony Perkins on this wonderful Friday. Hope you've had a good week. Looking forward to a great weekend, I'm hoping, as we roll into fall here. So this is Washington Watch. It's the program powered by the Family Research Council. And I want to tell you, Tony is on a really unique trip. I read an article about this earlier today. He's in Egypt. For the first time, Christian evangelicals are meeting with Egypt's president. And among the issues addressed is their concern about the plight of the Christian community in Egypt. And we're going to be talking about persecuted Christians in the last segment of the broadcast today. So I want to encourage you to stay tuned and listen to that, because upcoming this weekend is the International Day of Prayer for the Persecuted Church. And we all want to make sure, you know, we should be remembering our brothers and sisters around the world, you know, if possible, a little bit every day. But there's a special day coming up this weekend to recognize and remember them, and hopefully sort of cement that in our minds, because that's such an important thing but to pray for our brothers and sisters around the world who are being persecuted just because of their faith. Well, we've got a very full show today. We've got four guests, four segments. Up first, you know, tax reform is on everybody's mind. And I suppose you all are wondering, what does it mean for you? I certainly am looking at the information as it's coming out and reading it and wondering that same question. David Christensen, Vice President for Government Affairs with the Family Research Council, is going to be with us here in just a moment. He's been crunching the numbers and reading between the lines, and he'll be here to help us understand what it does and doesn't do. We could do a whole hour on that one for sure. And a big religious liberty victory in Louisiana. The First Circuit Court ruled that the Democratic governor significantly overreached his authority. We've never heard of that before, have we? By creating a protected class for transgender individuals. Louisiana Solicitor General Elizabeth Murrell will be here with an update on that case. And we could do a full show just on campus craziness, couldn't we? Good news, though, at Georgetown University, at least for the moment. That school has postponed a ruling on whether the campus group Love Saxa, yes, that's, I said it right, it's S-A-X-A, and we'll find out what that means, can be recognized for embracing the biblical view of marriage. Imagine that. A founding member of that organization and Government Affairs Office Coordinator for the Family Research Council, Kelly Markham, will be here to explain that to us. And then finally, as I mentioned a moment ago, Sunday is the International Day of Prayer for the Persecuted Church, and we'll talk with Commissioner Christine McMillan. She's the Associate Secretary General for Public Engagement with the World Evangelical Alliance. And, of course, in that last segment, we'll be asking you to call in and talk with our guest about that International Day of Prayer for the Persecuted Church. Well, House Republicans unveiled their tax reform bill on Thursday, yesterday, leaving in place current 401k retirement plans and eliminating some state deductions. Entitled the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, that's TCJA for short, it includes several important values provisions that will provide long-needed relief for working families, begin to roll back the Johnson Amendment. You know, we've been hearing about that from the Trump administration for a while, actually since before the election, and recognize, this is cool, and recognize in the tax code the personhood of the unborn child. That's not a done deal for sure, but we're going to talk with David Christensen here in just a second. I want to ask him about that particular provision. David is the Vice President for Government Affairs with the Family Research Council. David, welcome to the broadcast today.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Okay, well, what I want to do first is just ask you to give us an overview as best you can of some of the key provisions of this tax thing. It's called the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, as I said, TCJA. So tell us, what have you filtered out of all the information coming out?
Well, there's a lot of information, to be sure. The gist of it is that this is not just a series of tax cuts, but a tax reform package that the Senate, the House of Representatives and the White House wanted to make to get in effect on the corporate side as well as on the individual side. So basically the House bill introduced reduces the personal tax brackets to four brackets, to 12%, 25%, 35%, and they are leaving a higher bracket at 39%. And then increasing the child tax credit and doing some things I'll talk about. But they're also dropping the corporate rate, I believe, down to 20%. A lot of jobs seem to be going overseas because companies are taxed less, say, in Germany than they are in the United States. And so this is just not only cutting taxes, but they're trying to reform and eliminate a lot of those taxes and the loopholes while still trying to make sure that middle class working families will see tax cuts.
So, you know, there's always this is supposed to simplify the tax code. The tax code is a mess. I mean, I remember when I used to be able to do my own tax returns, just, you know, pulling out the old Form 1040 or the short Form 1040.
Sure,
and you could
actually
read through the instructions and figure it out. I've been using, you know, either TurboTax or one of those other software programs for many, many years because it's impossible to figure out, you know, what your taxes should be. You have to buy a $40 every year a piece of computer
yep.
code to work your way through, and then you're really not sure if you did it right. So, what's other than maybe reducing from seven to it initially it was three tax brackets.
Right.
Now, as you said,
correct.
they're going to four. They're going to keep that higher
right.
bracket.
Right.
I would assume that's to keep the dogs off the ones the typical Democrat line, which is that this is going to be a tax cut for the rich. That's what they
right.
they sort of blithely say every single time there's any attempt to improve the tax code. So other than reducing the number of tax brackets, what are some of the key things that are going to make it simpler for you and I to figure out how much of our hard-earned money we have to send to Washington?
It's a good question. So a number of things. One is that instead of the standard deduction, which most individuals could take couples for $12,000, it would be $24,000, just the standard deduction off the top of your gross income. So right there is allowing people to keep more of their own money. That's going to directly impact their bottom line, their pocketbooks. They have gotten rid of some of the personal exemptions. People could take an exemption for themselves or a dependent or kids. And there's just a lot of different ways to do it. So one of the things they're doing is just saying, okay, we're going to get rid of some of these things and increase the standard deduction to offset that so it's more of a level playing field. And then for families with kids, increase the child tax credit from $1,000 per child to $1,600. There's a $300 parent credit as well, dependent credit. So we would like to see that actually go instead of $1,600 up to $2,000. FRC initiated the child tax credit in the 90s, well before I was associated with FRC. But we really think it's important to make sure that families with kids are being supported as well as, you know, just trying to create all the different kinds of provisions that people, you know, they may get all kinds of benefits depending on what the tax provision is. So by reforming and getting rid of some of these, they have put the child tax credit in. They've removed the marriage penalties from both the child tax credit and from the income tax brackets. That's a big victory for families. It makes no sense to tax married couples more than you would a single individual, discouraging marriage, discouraging family formation.
David, that's a question I wanted to ask you. You know, we've heard about the term that I think you're referring to. It's called the marriage penalty. Can you
sure.
explain briefly what the marriage penalty is and how and what kind of tax changes, what kind of changes in the law would eliminate that marriage penalty?
Yeah, so most of the tax brackets had penalties where if you file as an individual, single individual, you would get taxed at a certain income threshold. Theoretically, if you get married, you should just double that income threshold, and then you would get taxed at that amount. But that's not the way it worked. The way it worked is, for instance, you know, I think they've changed it so, you know, for instance, you know, on the child tax credit had a marriage penalty. At $55,000, you would get taxed at as an individual up to $75,000. If you double that, you would say, well, a married couple would get taxed at $150,000. Instead,
right.
A married couple was getting taxed the same amount at $110,000. So you're penalizing effectively marriage.
Right.
They're getting rid of that. So, for instance, the new 25% bracket starts at $90,000 per couple, and it's $45,000 per individuals. So, you know, it shows you that there's parity between the individual and individuals who obviously are married.
Yeah, that's good. And of course, as we all know, legislation and tax code can be engineered in such a way as to some people would, you know, people who are not in favor of eliminating the marriage penalty would say, well, you're giving an unfair advantage to people who are married. But, you know, if you want to encourage things like marriage, which we really need to encourage, if you want to help parents who are raising children, which we certainly want to do, then you can make some little tweaks in the tax code to do that, right?
Right. And I think, you know, typically married couples and married, you know, families tend to be one of the drivers of the economy. Typically, you know, it's more expensive to have kids, obviously, but they've also done studies to show that, you know, a lot of times being in a family, people work harder, longer hours, therefore they're contributing more to the economy. And
right.
Obviously, you know, having kids is good for, you know, these are future taxpayers. So, you know, playing field is important.
Yeah, we definitely want to encourage all those good things that solid family. I mean, we know, our listeners know, that solid families are the foundation of a solid society and a solid culture. So, you know, let's help them out in every way we can. I want to ask you about just a note here that I have that there's a request to allow an unborn child to qualify for a tax credit for children. How would that work, and where is that?
Yeah, we're really excited about that. You know, it's interesting that that there are a few provisions in law that allow, you know, recognize an unborn child, say under the Children's Health Insurance Program, states can recognize an unborn child for the purpose of getting CHIP money. And we've been kind of pushing behind the scenes to recognize the unborn child as a qualifying child in some of the tax code. And so the House bill would allow an unborn child to be recognized for the purposes of education savings accounts. So, you know, this would be tax-exempt money. People can put money into an education savings account, grow it up over the years so that when their kids are ready to go into school, that would be allowed to be used for tuition, et cetera. We thought that, you know, recognizing that, you know, a child, an unborn child, would give families an additional year that they could start to develop and put money aside for an education savings account. So we thought that that's a really good win. You know, this really isn't an abortion issue. I know that NARAL and a couple pro-abortion groups, you know, pitched a fit already. Bottom line is, it's not stopping abortion. It's just allowing the parents to maintain, you know, and recognize that their unborn child, in fact, is a child, and they can start putting some money away for that. So we think this is really a positive pro-family provision. You know, and we're going to look to see that it makes it through the House process and the Senate process.
That's great. Well, you know, I've got a whole bunch of other stuff here on, you know, the Johnson Amendment and all those sorts of things. And as I said, we don't have time for that. It would take an hour to get through all this. But, David, thanks so much for joining us today. We appreciate your insight and hope to get you back on in the near future. All right. Well, we've got another segment coming up here. We're going to be talking with Elizabeth Murrell, the Louisiana Solicitor General, about a state appeals court ruling against the governor of Louisiana when we come back.
We've gone from give me liberty or give me death to take care of me, please. What has happened to the American spirit? Our colleges were once bastions of free speech. Now they're bastions of speech codes. Our culture once rewarded independence. Now it rewards victimhood. Parents once taught their kids how to fend for themselves. Now any parent who tries may get a visit from the police. In a talk about his new book, Not a Daycare, Dr. Everett Piper, president of Oklahoma Wesleyan University, takes a hard look at what's happening around the country, including demands for safe spaces and trigger warnings at universities like Yale, Brandeis, and Oberlin, and digs in his heels against the sad and dangerous dumbing down of the American spirit. Dr. Piper has become known for his passionate defense of intellectual freedom, and he challenges the intolerant tolerance of today's academic community. Go to frc.org/speakers to watch. Again, that's frc.org/speakers. In a free country like ours, it's easy to forget that slavery still exists. Human beings are being trafficked and sold for sex against their will. Human trafficking is a horrifying scourge that continues to haunt America, particularly through the proliferation of illegal online transactions between traffickers and buyers. As part of the FRC Speaker Series, Congresswoman Ann Wagner discusses congressional anti-human trafficking initiatives and how the conservative community can best be engaged in combating this horrific crime. Congresswoman Wagner, who introduced highly anticipated legislation in April that allows states and victims to fight online sex trafficking, focuses on online sex trafficking via Backpage.com and other websites, and confronting the demand for sex trafficking in American culture. Find out more about Congresswoman Wagner's recent legislation and ways you can help stop trafficking at frc.org/speakers. Again, that is frc.org/speakers.
Is being right enough to win an election? Many tend to believe that being right, in the sense of being factually correct, is sufficient to win in politics. Unfortunately, political history proves otherwise. The candidate who organizes and communicates the best will beat the opposition, no matter how right the other side is. Christians who are running for public office have a moral obligation to study and learn how to win. They must discover the real nature of politics. Robert Arnakis knows how to win. As senior director for the Leadership Institute, the nation's premier public policy training organization, he has 15 years of grassroots organizing, campaign, fundraising, and communications experience, and has established himself as one of the country's top political trainers. Here, Mr. Arnakis discusses the real nature of politics and how to overcome the odds to win an election. Go to frc.org/speakers to view this timely discussion.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. Eben Fowler sitting in for Tony Perkins this afternoon. Hey, I want to give a shout-out to our producer, Russ Jones. He did an awful lot of work today, and some of it I didn't get to in the first segment. But I do want to mention how this TCGA, the tax program called Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, would potentially impact the Johnson Amendment that kind of muzzles pastors all over the country from getting involved and engaged and kind of keep holding them back and talking about issues and even candidates. I'll just read you one paragraph here. TCGA protects churches from losing their tax-exempt statuses due to the Johnson Amendment, which was founded by our good buddy Lyndon back in the 50s, for political speech, and here's a quote, in any homily, sermon, teaching, dialectic, or other presentation made during religious services or gatherings, which is in the ordinary course of the organization's regular and customary activities in carrying out its exempt purpose and results in the organization incurring not more than de minimis incremental expenses. Well, that's government speak for let's see if we can get rid of the Johnson Amendment. So I just wanted to thank Russ for the extra work he did on that and wanted to get that bit in. So on to our next segment. On Wednesday of this week, an appellate court panel found that Governor John Bel Edwards of Louisiana went too far when trying to ban discrimination against transgender people in state government. The case has been part of an ongoing battle over authority between the Democratic governor and the Republican Attorney General, Jeff Landry. So I'd like to welcome to the broadcast Elizabeth Murrow. She's the Louisiana Solicitor General. Welcome to Washington Watch, Elizabeth.
Well, thank you. Good afternoon.
All right. Well, first of all, give us a little bit of background here. What did the governor try to do?
Well, the governor issued an executive order in this case, and he expanded some of the protected classes that are in current law to include gender identity and sexual orientation. That was basically what he did with his order. He also extended it to all private contractors who provide professional services to state government, and impose that language on private contractors under a threat of terminating their contracts if they refuse to add that language to their contracts.
So it would have been retroactive had it gone into effect.
It was being applied to existing contracts. He had refused to approve certain contracts that were already in play and was requiring that they add that language to their contracts as well. So not just new contracts, but old contracts.
Okay, so any idea, I mean, you work obviously with Attorney General Landry, any idea why the governor felt he needed to try to get this thing through?
You know, our view of it all along has been that he couldn't get it through the legislature. There had been legislation that was submitted 6 years in a row, rejected by the legislature, and so he couldn't get it done the right way, so he tried to issue an executive order and do it that way.
My understanding was he was using kind of as an excuse or a reason, depending upon your point of view, your perspective, is that this is the same thing that former President Obama already had in effect and actually is still in effect, right?
That's right. Obama issued an order and added that language to a pre-existing anti-discrimination order that essentially tracked the original order, essentially tracked federal law. President Obama added the gender identity language to the existing order, and but his order was very, very different from what Governor Edwards' order did. And Governor Edwards consistently has compared the two and said that they're identical. But if you read them, you can see that they are clearly not identical. The Obama executive order, which President Trump has continued in effect, very clearly and unambiguously states that it does not create any new legal rights or any cause of action. So it's not a threat because it doesn't actually expand the classes that are in existing law. Edwards's did.
So what are the existing groups that have been sort of singled out in the general anti or non-discrimination policy?
The new ones, the new classes that were created were for under sexual orientation and gender identity.
Okay, but prior to that, what were
prior
the classes?
Prior to that, it was sex, race, age, national origin. I mean, it was kind of the
standard stuff.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sex has been a term that has been litigated quite a bit in the last year, because of some activity that occurred under the Obama administration, where they tried to, through the Department of Justice and the Department of Education, and they tried to redefine the term sex under Title IX and Title VII. That's not exactly what Governor Edwards did. He added those phrases to an existing list of protected classes, whereas the Obama administration originally tried to basically redefine an existing word in federal law.
Why do you suppose the governor felt that transgenders, homosexuals needed to have a special classification? Why do you think transgenders and homosexuals themselves may feel that way?
I have always found that the two terms don't quite fit together, especially in this particular context. So I think that was always a problem that we raised in the litigation, that sexual orientation is different and gender identity is different, and the two terms have very different implications in the law. So gender identity, for example, the definition that is promoted for gender identity as a protected class is it's a subjective identifying factor. You subjectively
right.
determine how you identify, and then mm-hmm. everybody else has to adapt to however you subjectively identify. And if you had or if anyone had read the guidance that was issued by the Obama administration, it essentially said that schools and anybody implementing Title IX essentially couldn't ask. So anyone could come in on any given day and say, I've changed, how I identify, and now everyone had to adapt to that. And so the law has never been built that way. It's not built around a subjective view of gender. It's built around a binary biological view of gender. And
well,
so when
right.
you change
yeah, the
that...
Way, the way we've always kind of looked at it in the past. So essentially what you're saying is you can tell if somebody is a particular race or skin color. You can determine objectively what their national origin is and so on and so forth versus, and of course this is a big, big debate. The homosexual community wants to say, this is who we are, this is how we were born, and then, the rest of us would contest that. So in about 20 seconds here, do you think that this ruling is going to hold?
I do. Yes, I do.
Okay.
I think it's legally correct and it'll hold.
Very good. Elizabeth Murrell, the Louisiana Solicitor General, we really appreciate you coming on Washington Watch today. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
All right, coming up next, we're going to be talking with Family Research Council's Kelly Markham about something going on at Georgetown University with an organization called Love Saxa. Stick around with us. We'll see you on the other side of the break here on Washington Watch.
Every day, the Christian worldview is increasingly being pushed out of the public square and out of public policy. Family Research Council is an organization that works to advance faith, family, and freedom in public policy and culture from a Christian worldview. We want you to know that we are your advocate in our nation's capital. To learn more about FRC, go to frc.org and follow us on social media to receive our action alerts and stay up to date on the latest news.
Is being right enough to win an election? Political history proves otherwise. The candidate who organizes and communicates the best will beat the opposition, no matter how right the other side is. Christians who are running for public office have a moral obligation to study and learn how to win. They must discover the real nature of politics. Robert Ornakis is one of the country's top political trainers. Hear him discuss the real nature of politics and how to overcome the odds to win an election at frc.org/speakers.
The Family Research Council had the pleasure of hosting Dr. Michael Paulson to speak about how Christians can respond to arguments against religious liberty. Dr. Paulson argues that religion is different and deems exemptions within the law. A religious person believes in God, and God's sovereignty requires complete devotion, whereas government only requires allegiance and civil duties. The Constitution itself treats religion differently, giving America religious liberty and the freedom to exercise. Visit frc.org/university to hear more about this issue.
If you had to make a law, where would you start? America's founding fathers determined law from a fixed source, God, but culture has shifted the focus to man's self-determined law. If truth is no longer determined by God, it becomes subjective and open to interpretation. In an incisive new paper, Peter Johnston traces the origins of these dangerous trends in American law and the importance of staying true to our founding principles. To view FRC's new publication, go to frc.org/decay.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. Eben Fowler with VOD Radio Network sitting in today for Tony Perkins, who is over in Egypt. And he's on a really remarkable trip. I talked about it at the top of the hour. He's visiting or has visited with the president of Egypt. And among the issues that were addressed by that group were the concern for the plight of the Christian community in Egypt. And, of course, it goes much further than that. In our final segment, we're going to be talking with somebody about that very important topic, the International Day of Prayer for the Persecuted Church. Well, here we are sitting in Kansas City. Just appreciate those of you who are listening today. You're going to have an opportunity to join us in the last segment and talk with our final segment guest. So we'll be giving out the phone number here in just a few minutes. But before that, I want to introduce you to Kelly Markham. She's with Family Research Council. We kind of had a double hit today, two FRC staffers. And by the way, FRC does some incredible work. I think I mentioned last time I was on the air that I had been at the Values Voter Summit in Washington and just working with the FRC people and getting an even better understanding of the influence they have in our nation's capital. They're doing some great work. So anyway, Kelly Markham is with Family Research Council, a reasonably recent graduate of Georgetown University. Kelly, welcome to Washington Watch.
Hi, thank you so much for having me on.
All right. Well, you started or you were one of the founding members of an organization called Love Saxa. That's S-A-X-A. Would you first of all let our listeners know what that means and what the group is all about, why it was founded at Georgetown?
Absolutely. So Love Saxa is a play on the Georgetown chant, Hoya Saxa, which we yell at sporting events, et cetera. It means what rocks. It's a very nerdy Greek-Latin term that they came up with way back when. So Love Saxa, so translated to love rocks, Saxa being rocks in Latin, is the name that we gave to our group, which was an affiliate of the Love and Fidelity Network. And the group is on campus, and it's dedicated to defending sexual integrity on the university campus. So that means fighting the hookup culture, talking about sexual assault, kind of cultivating healthy relationships, combating pornography, and defending traditional marriage on campus.
So
and
there
we
chapters?
Founded that, yeah.
Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, so we founded that starting back in 2012, 2013, moving forward, because we saw this void on campus that sexual integrity was under brutal attack in the post-sexual revolution world, particularly on campuses, and Georgetown was being silent on the issue. And so we were seeing the harms inflicted by this culture on our peers, who were very much embroiled in this kind of sexual hedonism type culture. And so we decided to do something about it, and we got involved with the Love and Fidelity Network through there.
Do you remember the name Sandra Fluke?
Yes, I do.
Was she from Georgetown?
She was at Georgetown Law, so I believe that controversy happened around spring of 2012. I think her testimony was April 12th, so that would have been the end of my freshman year, and she was in the law school at that time.
So for our listeners who don't remember that name, she was the young lady who demanded that we pay for her birth control. And I thought that was rather an odd thing to come out publicly and talk about and sort of make a fool of yourself. But that's what she did. And it kind of points to, whether it was the law school or the university in general or whatever university, it points to kind of how crazy it has gotten. And so how does Love Saxa is the name of the organization at Georgetown. Are there similar organizations at other universities? And we're going to get into the meat of this topic here in just a second, but just wanted to lay a little bit of groundwork.
Yeah, absolutely. So as I said, we're an affiliate of the Love and Fidelity Network, or we were at the time of founding, and I know they're still involved with it currently. So that Love and Fidelity Network has chapters at other campuses. There's one in Yale, there's one at Princeton, there's one at the University of Pittsburgh, to name a few. And they're non-religious groups. Of course, much of their membership is very religious. However, the groups themselves are non-religious, and they approach the issue from a kind of a philosophical standpoint, and they approach the marriage issue using, you know, non-religious arguments that are accessible to secular audiences. But it really just looks at the human person and how sexual integrity is critical to the flourishing of the human person.
All right. So the meat of this issue and the reason we're talking with you is because there's been sort of a brouhaha, if I may say, on the Georgetown campus and coming from the administration as a result of somebody whining and complaining that you actually think that traditional marriage is a good thing. Tell us we're running out of time, but if you could quickly tell us about the controversy and where it's going.
Yeah, so the petition was filed by two LGBTQ student activists on campus to the university, saying that Love Saxa for years has been fostering hatred and intolerance. And so through due course, they were granted a hearing. Love Saxa was granted a hearing where they were essentially put on trial in front of 12 student activities commissioners. So these are students. And the students, after hearing the case against Love Saxa, which essentially boiled down to the fact that Love Saxa stands for traditional marriage and views, pornography and the hookup culture, as well as homosexual marriage, same-sex marriage, to be an aberration within sexual integrity. So that basically boiled down. That was the main complaint. The commission voted 8-4 to recommend not to sanction Love Saxa, so to allow them to keep functioning.
So if they held the view that traditional marriage was unacceptable, you probably would be tolerant of that, I would assume. You wouldn't say that their whatever group they have should be thrown off campus, but it seems like it doesn't go the other way, does it?
It really doesn't, which has huge implications both for censorship on campus, but also Georgetown is a Catholic university, and the administration needs to step up and needs to make that abundantly clear.
That's right.
That these are also Catholic teachings.
Kelly, it kind of doesn't make sense, does it? Well, Kelly, we are out of time. Thanks so much for joining us on today's Washington Watch. Coming up next in our final segment, we'll be talking with Commissioner Christine McMillan. She's the Associate Secretary General for Public Engagement with the World Evangelical Alliance. And we're going to be talking about the International Day of Prayer for the Persecuted Church coming up in our final segment. And we'll also be taking your calls.
Are you worried about the moral direction of America? Do you feel powerless to make a difference? Family Research Council is an organization that works to advance faith, family, and freedom in public policy and culture from a Christian worldview. Established in 1983 in Washington, D.C., Family Research Council conducts research, develops policy, drafts legislation, and educates policymakers, pastors, and the grassroots. It testifies before Congress and shapes public debate through the media and internet. Every day, the Christian worldview is increasingly being pushed out of the public square and out of public policy. We want you to know that we are your advocate in our nation's capital. To learn more about Family Research Council, please visit us at frc.org and follow us on social media to receive our action alerts and stay up to date on the latest news. Again, that's frc.org.
In a free country like ours, it's easy to forget that slavery still exists. Human beings are being trafficked and sold for sex against their will. Human trafficking is a horrifying scourge that continues to haunt America, particularly through the proliferation of illegal online transactions between traffickers and buyers. As part of the FRC Speaker Series, Congresswoman Ann Wagner discusses congressional anti-human trafficking initiatives and how the conservative community can best be engaged in combating this horrific crime. Congresswoman Wagner, who introduced highly anticipated legislation in April that allows states and victims to fight online sex trafficking, focuses on online sex trafficking via Backpage.com and other websites, and confronting the demand for sex trafficking in American culture. Find out more about Congresswoman Wagner's recent legislation and ways you can help stop trafficking at frc.org/speakers. Again, that is frc.org/speakers.
If you had to make a law, where would you start? America's founding fathers determined law from a fixed source, God, but culture has shifted the focus to man's self-determined law. If truth is no longer determined by God, it becomes subjective and open to interpretation. In an incisive new paper, Peter Johnston traces the origins of these dangerous trends in American law and the importance of staying true to our founding principles. To view FRC's new publication, go to frc.org/decay.
The Family Research Council had the pleasure of hosting Dr. Michael Paulson to speak about how Christians can respond to arguments against religious liberty. Dr. Paulson argues that religion is different and deems exemptions within the law. A religious person believes in God, and God's sovereignty requires complete devotion, whereas government only requires allegiance and civil duties. The Constitution itself treats religion differently, giving America religious liberty and the freedom to exercise. Visit frc.org/university to hear more about this issue.
You're listening to Washington Watch. This is Evan Fowler with Bot Radio Network filling in today for my friend Tony Perkins, and glad to have you along. Let me give you a little bit of social media stuff here. FRC.org is the website if you want to learn more about what Family Research Council does. And they have a great daily email that keeps you informed about what's going on, about the most important issues of our day. And if you go to FRC.org, just poke around and look for the newsletter, subscription thing. At T. Perkins is Tony's Twitter handle. At Eben Fowler is mine. And we're glad to have you here listening with us today. Let me give you the phone number. We're going to be talking about the persecuted church. This Sunday is the International Day of Prayer for the Persecuted Church. And here's what I'd like to have you think about. I'd like to know what your family does, what you do, what your church does to remember our persecuted brothers and sisters around the world. I'd like to kind of generate some ideas because, you know what, we've got it really easy here in the United States. You know, certainly we have some persecutions of various types that go on. And there are organizations like FRC, Alliance Defending Freedom, and a number of other, there's some legal, other legal organizations that are working full time and working really hard on some things that pertain to that. But some of the things our brothers and sisters endure around the world are horrendous, and we need to be praying for them. So what I want to have you do is just think for a few minutes while we're talking with our guest here in just a minute about some of the things that, again, your family, that you, your kids, your church are doing to remember our brothers and sisters around the world. The number is 866-66-372-7234. Well, as I mentioned, this Sunday is the International Day of Prayer for the Persecuted Church. The day is charged with raising awareness of global persecution against Christians. With us now is Commissioner Christine McMillan. She's the Associate Secretary General for Public Engagement with the World Evangelical Alliance. And Christine is part of the WEA Senior Leadership Team. And she's been a commissioner with the Salvation Army, serving on four different continents. In her role, she's coordinating WEAs, and that's, again, World Evangelical Alliance's engagement in advocacy on a number of issues, and also heads up our engagement at the United Nations. Christine, welcome to Washington Watch.
Well, it's good to be here with you.
Well, tell us, give us kind of an overview, if you can, and I know it's very difficult because there is so much persecution going of Christians, and well, and others, of course, but we're talking about Christians right now going on around the world. What in your experience, is going on these days?
Well, we're looking at millions in terms of numbers. It's thought there's over 100 million persecuted Christians on a daily basis. And that can take the form of harassment. They can be beaten physically, discriminated against, imprisoned, and yes, even killed. And some of this is thought to be going on to a high degree in 60 nations. We know that Christians are the largest identifiable group denied basic human rights.
Yeah, that's amazing. I heard that too, Christine, recently, that, you know, if you're a Christian, you are in that group that's targeted in many places and by many people, whether it's governments or groups like ISIS or, you know, terrorists. Those of us who are Christians who name the name of Christ are on the hit list as infidels. And so what are some of the countries where it's the worst, if you would?
Well, that's interesting because it's the way in which the persecution, the form in which it takes. We know that North Korea is a very difficult place to be a Christian these days. We know that in Pakistan there are blasphemy laws targeting Christians on their ideals, and we know that the gospel is a gospel of good news that we want to share, and so in their sharing, they're targeted with bombings. There's abduction of women, and there's rape. And we also know that even in a place like Nigeria, where you have two strong faith groups, we see the large Christian church attending on Sunday morning worship. But in the way in which conflict begins to rear itself is when people become close to each other in neighborhoods, and they begin to watch each other with suspicion. Sudan is another place where there is a lot of discrimination against Christians. So Sri Lanka, even though it's a secular state, there were 220 incidents of discrimination just last year. And Iran, of course, there were 193 Christians in 2016 arrested or imprisoned just because they are a Christian.
Now, I noted that you head up our engagement at the United Nations. Tell us about what you do at the United Nations, and is the United Nations doing anything about this?
Well, we know that the United Nations, by structure, has a department and rapporteur on religious freedom. I have personally visited that department in Geneva and shared with the fact that the World Evangelical Alliance represents 600 million Christians in all variation environments of the world with respect to persecution. Our discussion, I felt, was fruitful in that at the end of our discussion, they asked if they could be put on the mailing list for our newsletters from the World Evangelical Alliance where incidents of persecution are identified. And they wanted to know that, and they wanted to follow up. So we do have a working relationship with the UN on identifying those issues. There is also at the UN on an annual basis a high-level dialogue on religious freedom, and we do get involved in that. But that is a very public space, and the World Evangelical Alliance, through its footprint at the UN, then gets to meet with various top officials from different nations. And a lot of our work in developing an awareness of persecution is behind closed doors to advocate and to find ways in which peace can come when parties start meeting together and raise awareness on this issue.
So what are some of the things that are actually being done? And let me just hold on that question for a second. I want to give out our phone number again and again ask our listeners if they would like to engage and talk about some of the things that they are doing personally to recognize, to support, to help our brothers and sisters around the world who are being persecuted. And that phone number is 866-372-7234, 866-372-7234. So the question is, what are, you know, there's obviously dialogue and discussion and being informed and all that sort of thing, but what are some of the on-the-ground things that you can identify that are being done to help put a stop to this rampant problem around the world?
Well, it's to give identity and legitimacy to the Christian faith in other nations. So, for example, a very practical issue is the registration of church buildings. And we have gone ahead and had that discussion that laws would be changed and that there would be less harassment against Christians having to move from worship center to worship center to worship center, and that indeed in the nation that we're discussing with, that there's a legitimacy of registration of Christian church buildings. That might not sound like a lot, but when people agree to that, they're agreeing to the fact that Christians have a right to worship and they have a right to be present in that society to worship. We do know that even persecution, though, we think about the nation of Egypt where the Coptic community have worship taking place on a Sunday morning and are bombed in the midst of their worship. So it's one thing to have a place to worship. It's another thing to ensure that that place is safe, secure, and there's a freedom to worship without looking over your shoulder.
Well, you know, we just talked about at the beginning of this segment, I think I reiterated that Tony Perkins, president of Family Research Council, is in Egypt, and he met, among a number of other leaders, with the president of Egypt. And that's one of the things that they talked about. So obviously, it has an awful lot to do with who's at the top, doesn't it? Who is the president of the country? Who is in political leadership?
It does. And it also behooves us in the Christian community to find out where the violation of human rights is taking place. Now, in some incidents, there are people who are imprisoned, and we never hear from them. But we get to know their names, we get to know their story, and we identify that story, whether it's in the press or the media, and bring it to the nations themselves, the government, and identify the violation of rights that took place. In some cases, we also are able to identify that that nation perhaps has signed on to an agreement so that persecution would not take place. So you're rearing its ugly head, so to speak. You're bringing it out into the open. Because persecution often is done behind closed doors. We don't know all the numbers in terms of martyrdom. And so we want to be on the watch and then take what we see and bring it into the circles that where something can be done.
Well, Tracy is on the line from Texas. Tracy, welcome to Washington Watch. You have a question or a comment?
Hi, thank you. Yes, I just had a comment. I just wanted to ask everybody to remember the Christians in Palestine, they're forgotten about a lot, and they have a hard time over there. My ex-husband's a Christian Palestinian, and I don't think people realize how hard they have it.
Well, Christine, thank you, Tracy. Christine, tell us what you know about what's going on with our brothers and sisters in Palestine.
Tracy, thank you for raising that, and you're exactly right. And we have had many discussions with the Palestinian authorities and favorable response. And one of the issues is sometimes how nations are geographically placed and how they are recognized or not, even with access into their worship centers, into the schools that they want to attend, sometimes by having to cross borders. And so we are in constant conversation with the Palestinian authorities on the plight of Christians, and indeed even on the registration of churches. And I think we're moving forward.
The number is 866-372-7234, 866-372-7234 will get you on board the program. Christine, what is the United States, the current administration, doing to deal with persecution around the world?
Well, sometimes we identify the issues in terms of looking at what is the radical right or the radical fundamentalists who begin to draw out their right to exclusively exist. And I think in the U.S., we're trying to strike a balance to that and suggesting that we always have to identify another religion not as exclusively a threat to us, but we have to look at those fundamentalist characteristics, those terrorist characteristics, and be able to separate the mainstream of religious faith and practice from the extremes. And I think Christians, as they become good neighbors, as they get to know brothers and sisters within the Christian community, but also outside the Christian community, begin to attract a form of peacekeeping and a form of acknowledging one another in peace and not with threat.
And then what kind of we've been talking about around the world, but let's talk about here in the United States. What are some of the examples or a couple examples you can think of or name that you would include on the list of persecution of Christians here?
Well, sometimes our own right to even identify our critical beliefs and foundations in terms of morals and ethics and the way in which we live out the gospel in our own lifestyle can be criticized. And we can be seen even as people who become marginalized. And I would even suggest to you that we're not seen as serious in terms of being part of the mainstream of society when we have these exclusive beliefs. And when I say exclusive, I look at Jesus Christ himself, and persecution has taken place right from the beginning of the gospel. And we have a gospel that believes that Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life.
That's right.
And when you begin to claim a Savior with truth, the way, and the life, people will begin to see themselves being imposed upon. And I think it's up to us as Christians to not only proclaim our statement of faith, but to live our statement of faith so they'll know we are Christians by our love, so that we get the balance of understanding as we approach even Advent, that Jesus was called also the Prince of Peace. Now, I don't deny the fact that we want to protect our rights to speak and live as Christian people. But let us also balance that with being good neighbors and letting others get to know us and to see the value of our faith and our practice.
Well, Christine, we are out of time. Thank you so much. Christine McMillan, Commissioner with WEA's, the World Evangelical Alliance's Associate Secretary General for Public Engagement. We appreciate your time and involvement today. Well, this is Eben Fowler sitting in today for Tony Perkins on this edition of Washington Watch. Y'all have a great weekend.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is a production of the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C. For more information on anything you heard today, or if you'd like to find out how you can support the ongoing efforts of the Family Research Council, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our new watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.